My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, everybody.
I'm scratching it.
Oh, goodness me. Hurry up, JB. And then as soon as I start talking. Right. I'm going to leave that in, actually, because that's a really nice insight for the listener to how hard this is.
Hello, everyone. He's picking his nose.
Here we go.
Lying in a coffin. I was scratching it.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Pilot Episodes, your infrequent flying podcast. As always, I'm joined by our three aviators, so I'll go round accordingly. Godders, how are you?
I'm very fine, JB.
Now, Godders, we've got a lot to talk about, i.e. where we've been, and we'll get to that in a minute, but you've been somewhere else. You've been to Hybrid Air Vehicles, one of my personal favourite places. Well, companies.
Well, so I didn't go there, but I did talk to them, the Airlander people, at the DSEI, the Defence Exhibition, at Excel in London, which, I tell you what, I've never been to this before, was flipping amazing.
Now, hang on. Is that otherwise known as the London Arms Fair?
If you happen to be the mayor of London, yes, possibly.
Is that what all the hubbub was about on Twitter?
Yes.
Oh, as soon as I saw that hubbub, all I could think of is, where do I buy tickets for this?
Yeah, well, I'm surprised you weren't there with your handler.
Yeah, well, quite.
I mean, surely that's the place for you.
There were quite a lot of people there without handlers.
Oh, really?
Taking photos of things.
So
honestly, if you want to buy a helicopter, there was a massive Leonardo helicopter sat in the middle of the room. These massive hangars, tanks, Parky, you would have loved the various guns that were around there. Scuba gear, especially
World War II guns.
I didn't see the World War II guns with patina.
Probably not, though.
And
if they were, you'd have probably bought them way overpriced.
And I did a little speech.
So, okay, ooh, that is exciting. What were your takeaways then from...
Just to yourself?
Yeah, I had a good word with myself in the corner of the Navy theatre that I gave the presentation with my Britney Boom mic on.
Did you have a miniskirt on as well?
Yes.
So,
shiny boots.
It was the Royal Air Force number 6.
So... What did you learn from DSI? What? Give me a couple of takeaways.
I thought the first Sea Lord, who was my warm act, was very good on the Navy relationship with the Royal Air Force, which, as Dunk will tell you, maybe wasn't so good back in the Joint Harrier days, but I think it's flipping brilliant now. So, you know, he majored on that, which is really cool to see. Other things was just how much tech there is around. There was a stand. I can't remember the company, but the guy was demoing this thing and it was full Minority Report.
Wow.
Sliding stuff on glass and everything like that. You know, computer stuff. Amazing.
Awesome.
Did you tell a joke?
Did I tell a joke I told a couple.
Give us the best one.
It was more of a quip about a pilot. I put up a picture and it had a F-35 pilot looking out of his cockpit with a beard. I did say 2 weeks ago that was a Royal Navy pilot, but this week that could be either. That's talk, how joint I am.
Talk about not, knowing not your
really
crowd,
a joke,
hey?
Though, is it?
Not a titter.
You're
the
in
audience.
A funny mood tonight, Mason.
No one even looked up.
Oh dear. Well, that little quip then there is from Parky. Parky, how are you, mate?
All good, thanks, JB.
Now, are things quietening down on the Spitfire front? All this bad weather and whatnot.
No, I have had a few days off, but I'm just about to start tomorrow another 5-day thrunge at headquarters.
So which reminds me, we haven't podded since it happened, have we?
What happened? What happened?
Ooh.
Oh, yeah. Like, amazing stuff. I mean, I've already congratulated you before, but I'll congratulate you on there. Congratulations, mate. 1,000 hours in a Spitfire.
There you go. Yeah,
if you know Parky and you've ever flown with him, means 450 hours and 550 for Parky when he does his logbook.
Ah.
not true. Always underselling the Spit, because then you'd end up getting more hours at the end of the year on BBMF. You always wanted to be tickling the late, you know, the least hours.
It's an old...
And then Mason would let you fly P7 again. Genius.
The thing is, Parky's prime for this. Parky's prime for this because he and I travelled down to the aircraft carrier together, and funnily enough, Godders, I said exactly the same thing. And after a long, long period of bickering, he came up with that. So he's primed with his excuse, which, you know, we all know is just an excuse.
So did you drop Parky?
But Parky, it is brilliant, mate. Well done. 1,000 hours in the Spitfire.
A cracking achievement.
You have joined.
It's been amazing. Do you know how many times I've got 1,000 hours? None. That's right.
Exactly, yeah.
You got 1,000 hours at a desk, mate.
Well, we did.
You chose a career, Goddess.
Yeah.
Look where it got you.
Exactly.
I get to wear microphones and speak to people.
Exactly. So, Britney Spears.
So all those jokes.
So what are we on now, Parky? We've got 1,000 hours in what?
I've got 1,000 hours.
I'm just going to go get me coat.
Tornado F3. Hawk with the Reds. Typhoon and now Spitfire.
Yeah. Yeah, see, we give you an awful lot of banter for looking a bit older. But actually, when you put all those hours in context, you look remarkably young.
Yeah, well, no, let's not go too far, JB.
How did he fit young?
Yeah.
How
just
did he fit
the
all
podcast,
in? Anyway,
we thought he was dead.
it is remarkable.
Parky, do I have permission to tweet that picture?
Yeah, go for it. I like it. Yeah. It does look like I'm in a coffin. I accept that.
Yeah. It looks like it's the mourning period where people come and view the body.
Yeah.
Well,
cracking, expensive coffin. Yeah.
Anyway, but I was going to be complimentary there, saying you're the only person on the planet with that collection of hours, right?
Must be.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess in those aircraft, you know, some mates probably got thousands of hours on lots of other stuff, though, haven't they?
Well, I wouldn't be sure that 1,000 on that, you know, even, what was that, five things, four things, five things?
Five.
Not that you're counting.
Five things,
well,
plus F-16 hours.
500 on an F-16, but, you know. Yeah,
oh, I've got more than you on that.
Small victories, God, as small victories.
Not as experienced as me on the F-16, then, Parker.
You see, I thought that was another case of you had 492, and again, you sharp-penciled it up to 500 and a half.
How many Goddards? Come on.
Well, I tell you the worst thing that I've got. In my logbook, because of Mason, I've got 99-hour Spitfire.
Really?
Oh, that's bad luck.
And you've got about 999 Harrier, and then how many?
980. I think it's 580.
Imagine that, being 3 hours away from being an elite pilot. Anyway.
That's why it became a rubber desk, Johnny.
And last but not least, Dunk. Now, Dunk, you look like from your WhatsApp messages, it looks like you're
weirdo.
Well, no, it looks like he's retraining on the same scheme as some young offender. You've been doing patios and bricklaying and all sorts.
Well, an old offender, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
But
turning your life around.
Yeah. Yeah, I haven't been doing any aviating. I've been sort of joining Goddard's, to be honest, in terms of, you know, not doing very much flying at all. But I have, I've done two things. So Goddard's hilarious joke did point at the fact that the Royal Air Force can now wear a beard.
I was about to ask about this. So why have they decided that this is a good idea?
Well, I'll tell you, because I rang up the station warrant officer to make sure that all was well. And actually, before we go any further, we should say that the reason I'm wearing a beard is actually because of Air Commodore Godfrey, who said when we were sort of, I was on leave and I was a bit bearded going down to the ship, and he said, oh, you can keep a beard as of next week, which I hadn't envied at all. So he said, go on, keep it. So I went, all right, I will.
So it's his fault. So the Navy have always had beards.
Navy have, Army haven't. Now, the reason that the Air Force have done it, so I rang up the station warrant officer to say, please could I wear a beard to work? And do you wear one? Not really sure. Do you wear a beard? Not really.
Yes, so.
Is it a false one then?
It comes off when I take my glasses off.
I was going to say for the listener, just to describe Dunk, he looks very much like Brian Blessed in Flash Gordon.
That was my best Brian Blessed.
Okay.
It was rubbish, wasn't it?
So why have they done it?
Pit stop, the anthill mob. You look like one of them.
Right, but the idea, right, just to get the reason out, is when I rang the warrant officer, I said, what do you think about it? And she said, I think it's great. It's to promote inclusivity across all cultures. And therefore, if one culture can grow a beard, why shouldn't everyone be able to grow a beard? But the thing for me is it means that I don't have to shave every day, which is great.
And there's recruiting in there as well, because although I think it might be dying out these days, but the trend is to be bearded.
Where are we recruiting from? Coffee shops? Are we looking for baristas to fly helicopters?
Baristas could be those...
Your hipsters. Hipster helicopter dudes.
Can you imagine?
Oh, God. Do you know what? It reminds me of when the police allowed sleeve tattoos. I'm against that. And actually, I'm against anything which is not really traditional. I'm okay with making exceptions for people, but on the whole, I think traditions are a good thing. We should
retain. You like a tweed jacket, don't you?
I've got several tweed jackets, actually.
Exactly.
Yeah. He was head-to-toe in tweed on Saturday night, wasn't it?
Yep, that's pretty much it. That's pretty much it.
Have you got a plus four? Have you got a tweed plus four?
No, I don't. I wouldn't mind one.
Come on.
Yeah.
That's traditional.
It is.
I want to see you in your plus four. What's that?
Do you have to trim it, or can you turn it into a great big bushy one?
No, you do have to trim it. I can't remember what the rules are, but there is a minimum and a maximum. So you have a 2-week growing period that you're allowed. And if you're if you were Goddard's, for instance, and you can't grow a beard, then after 2 weeks, you have to shave it off again.
Hang on. Out of the four of us around here, you picked me as the person who couldn't grow a beard.
Yeah, I think there is a more obvious candidate. It's JB.
Yes, it is me.
Well, is it?
Yeah. Isn't there serious reasons why the army can't grow beards? Is it something to do with respirators? Have I made that up?
Yeah, you made that up.
I'm pretty sure I have.
We all have to wear respirators. Not just the army that survives, is it? They've gassed us. Oh, we've lost the Navy and the Air Force. It's all right. The army are okay.
I'm pretty sure there's a good reason for it. I'm going to have to Google this.
They can't work as well with a beard, though, surely.
What?
A respirator.
It'd be all right.
I think you're doomed, Mason. If you're in your tutor and there's chemical weapons around, you're for it.
Yeah. It's not a tutor. It's a beefy prefect.
Oh, right. that suits the beard. Yeah. All right.
So this week, just to sort of move away from bricklaying and young offenders, it was I've been doing a bit of ground school, actually, for the prefect. So the last couple of weeks, which is very interesting. It's although I haven't flown it in this couple of weeks, it's a really nice little aeroplane, and I'm very excited about flying it.
Just for people who don't know what a prefect is, just describe it, Dunk.
So it is a It's a low-wing monoplane. It's a side-by-side trainer. It's a turboprop. It's got about 40 horsepower, which means it's – and it's got retractable undercarriage. So it's probably – well, it almost certainly is the most advanced elementary trainer the Royal Air Force has ever had. So it's a carbon fiber machine. It cruises at between 180 and 210 knots. It's got a max speed of 240. Goes up like a dingbat. And it's fully aerobatic, as you'd expect. It's fully glass cockpit. So what it's doing is it will prepare those fledgling students, those fledgling pilots that we train for glass cockpit operations. So right from the get-go now, you know, the training system is as up to speed as it can be, because they'll go prefect with the glass cockpit onto Texan with head-up display and glass cockpit, and then onto Hawk T2. Followed by either Typhoon or by F-35. But equally, if they go different routes, then of course all the multi-engine and rotary platforms are all that way as well. So it's a really good aeroplane to have, and it sort of brings the whole of the Air Force system bang up to date.
Well, most won't make it because they'll get chopped by you, Dunk. So.
Look at that, Flight Lieutenant Skull Crusher.
Oh, I picked up my Flight Lieutenant tabs today. I can't tell you how delighted I was.
Do you not use old ones that you had in the drawer that were now white?
I've been a squadron leader for so long that I could have
lent you a few, Dunk. In fact, given you a few.
Oh, yeah, I suppose so. I didn't think of that. Yours are really knackered, though, aren't they?
Speaking of head-up displays... This is probably a podcast in itself, so we'll only briefly mention it. But did you guys watch the ITV Real Top Gun Fighter Pilot programs?
I have not seen it.
I've tweeted a lot about this. What did you think, Parky?
That's not a good sign.
No, it was good. It held my interest.
That's tricky. You know,
they sort of just kept flipping through me between sort of Valley and then the Top Gun. I was surprised how... they so wanted to go F-35 Lightning and not Typhoon. It kind of, maybe that's, you know, how they sold it to make the story work better. But I mean, it was, they're a good bunch, and you know, they got there. What did you think?
I thought it was really good. I was a bit worried in the first 5 minutes, but actually the story that they put together, I thought it was a bit matey to start with. I mean, Skullcrusher would have never had that in his aeroplane with a student. But I tell you, the brilliant thing was that the traditions are all still there, but the kit has got so much better. How I've not flown in a Hawk T2. I mean, don't you have a million times? How good is that aeroplane?
That's belter.
I actually saw two of them today flying over the Conwy River.
Well, you know, the Hawk T1.
You saw both serviceable ones. Wow.
Hawk T1 was always a brilliant aeroplane. And the T2, again, sort of builds on that with the avionics it's got and synthetic radar and threat emulation. It's got so much stuff that prepares the boys and girls to go onwards to Typhoon and F-35. But just to go back to what you were saying, God, so I was teaching there when the guys on the program were there. And I think, you know, I don't think I'm wrong in saying that actually it's the other way around. The majority of guys want to go Typhoon because they perceive that as more... there'll be more flying rather than more simulation, and there it's more sort of pure flying. So everyone going through is the same as we always were, because, you know, you just want to fly the aeroplane. You know, you're not joining really to go, oh, I want to be a systems operator. You want to be a fighter pilot, and they want to fly. And so that sort of, that pervades all the way through, you know, the guys that are at that stage of training, that Typhoon is the way to go. And, you know, having been lucky enough to be involved in, you know, both Typhoon and F-35 in, you know, a small way, but to be able to go and see that and see what it does, I do, whenever I could, talk to the guys and say, you know, you really should consider F-35 is like a spaceship. It's great. So
so is there a slight bias against going to F-35 because there's less flying involved?
Yeah. I mean, in a nutshell, yeah.
Wow.
There's a lot of emulation.
But they're still fragged for, you know, pretty much the same amount of flying as a Typhoon pilot. And it's interesting that, you know, that there is that perception, I guess. I've just, if anyone gets a chance, have a look at the thread that I put on Twitter this evening about F-35. You know, and I'm comparing old school aeroplanes, you know, whether it's Harrier, Jaguar, whatever, back in the day, as your Nokia 3310 mobile phone and an F-35 as an iPhone. I mean, that's the difference. So that whether you're Typhoon or F-35, when it comes to doing a mission, you are operating that platform. You're not particularly flying it, you are operating that platform. So you know, both give huge levels of situational awareness, but F-35 is just unbelievable with the picture on that massive double iPad screen that the pilot's getting there. I mentioned in the speech at DSCI yesterday, it was about, you know, well, I won't bore you with the particular bit about decision making, but it is a straight fact that the pilot in the F-35 has more situational awareness than any other pilot in history, clearly apart from Parkey in the F4. But, I mean, it's straight fact. So it's just an interesting view. But I guess when you're going through Valley, you're just getting to grips with still flying an aeroplane, aren't you? As well as operating it.
I've just got a quick question, right? You said something right at the start. You felt the show was a bit matey. What does that mean?
Well, I think it was the way they put it across. And, you know, maybe it is a few years removed from the training system now, about 30 years removed from the training system, but it was quite formal. Yet in the early, they were taking these guys, and it might have been sort of bigged up for the television, but they were taking these guys flying, and instructor was calling the student mate, student was calling the instructor mate. It just surprised me.
Well, here's an example for you. Here's an example. Okay, so when I went through basic training on the Tucano RAF Cranwell, we were all dragged in. So there's 12 of us on the course. We were all dragged in by our course commander, who was a guy called Buster Crab with a great big handlebar moustache. And he then effectively gave us a massive telling off and said, right, you know, this is just out of order. He said, you will call all instructors, sir, in the air. There is a mark of respect, and you are to respect that. So he said, you know, I don't care what you call me on the ground, but in the air, you call me sir. And one of the guys on the course, a guy called Craig Brown, who we called Haggis, who was a Glaswegian, who sadly didn't make it through the course. But after Buster had said, you know, you can call me whatever you want on the ground, but you call me sir in the air, I'd have to bleep this out. He went, all right, beep. Called him the rudest name that you could possibly think of, and at which point there was absolute silence, followed by we all fell about laughing, and to his credit, so did Buster. But the point is that we used
did that student get chopped though?
Yes,
that's
he did,
why he didn't make it. Yeah. He's buried under the patio at Cranwell. Did.
But, you know, the point is that actually, when we went through flying training, your instructor in the air was always sir.
Hang on, I'm confused. I'd have assumed your instructor in the air and on the ground would be sir. Why aren't they sir all the time?
You're the same rank. So on the ground, you're the same rank. And so I guess tradition is you don't have to call someone of the same rank sir. But in the air, there is then that hierarchy within the
aeroplane. Right, I'm even more confused now. So you've got a trainee pilot. What rank are you, Dunk?
Well, now I'm a squadron leader.
Right.
No, so you're not.
I'm about to become a flight lieutenant, which I can't wait for.
Right. So when you get these new guys in, they're all flight lieutenants?
Yeah.
Why is that? I don't understand that. Why aren't the instructors...
Well, some of them are flying officers, but if they've been through university, very often they'll come out because some of them will have had bursaries, which means you're effectively an officer as you go through university, and they come out the end and they're already a flight lieutenant.
Yeah, but even if they're not...
Hang on, JB.
Why aren't the instructors higher rank?
Just consider what you're saying here. Are you saying that Dunk should be an Air Commodore?
Well, he should be more than a flight lieutenant, right?
Flight Lieutenant Phil.
This just shows
JB, I was only a flight lieutenant for 32 years.
Really?
Yeah.
This is baffling to me. I thought you'd...
I stormed through those ranks.
Hang on, Parky, did you do 32 years?
I did 35 years.
I was going to say, so you must
well,
have
that's
been
just a... gone up 3 years in the space of 20 seconds. Oh, Parky, how many did you do? 38 years. Parky, how many do you do now? 42 years.
I was a pilot officer
and a flight officer. I've got him now.
So there must be... Okay, so there must be seniority within the ranks, then. There must be grades of rank or seniority within the ranks.
No, there is, but you don't show it. Like, you don't have a pip for, you know, when you get to a senior position on top of your rank.
Huh. This baffles me. It completely baffles me. Right, so the point is, you have to call your instructor sir in the air, though.
Well, we did. You don't anymore, clearly, and that was the point Godders was making. It all seemed a bit matey.
Now, to be fair, I think, you know, there was a lot made of the fact that this was the first time these guys were going flying in a Hawk, and obviously they're on TV at that particular time. So there was a lot of excitement around the place. But actually, as you got past that first 5 minutes and into the swing of it, it was more formal because you could see the students working really, really hard. As always at Valley, trying to fly around the place and.
So, Dunk, do you make your students call you sir?
No,
sorry, I
can't believe that.
Dogs making weird noises out the back.
I don't like it one bit. Anyway, right. Well, that's fascinating. I've learned a lot in the last 10 minutes about ranks. So there you go.
Well, it's interesting that we were supposed to. We only have an hour tonight, don't we? And we said, right, we'll get straight into it. We want to talk about the aircraft carrier because we did some stuff down there. We need to talk about what we went and did.
We went on
and effectively, we've just talked about RC other stuff for the last 35 minutes.
Let's do that because we can't not talk about it for any longer. We went on an aircraft carrier, and that was pretty amazing stuff. So you guys have all been on an aircraft carrier before. I think maybe Parky hasn't.
I went on the... I've been on an American one, the Saratoga or something, back in the day when I was on Phantoms. We got helicoptered in from Cyprus, but that was the... and I've been on the... Is it the Illustrious, Dunk? The one that we were talking about in Malta?
It could be Illustrious or Ark Royal.
Yeah, one of those. So I have set foot... but only for about a couple of hours at a time.
But you've not flown off one, have you?
Or flown one.
Correct.
Yeah.
So what were your initial takeaways?
The whole, the way the thing was operating.
Hang on, boys. Hang on. Sorry, you've all cut out. So I'll ask that again. So, what were your initial impressions?
It's you,
are we
Parky?
On now?
Yeah. Sorry,
that's
it all froze. So I'll go with Parky first. What were your initial impressions?
Parky. I was blown away by it. It was awesome. It was huge. It was the fact that a team could build that thing, design it. It was, you know, getting prepped to go away. So, you know, we saw a bit of the logistics as they were loading everything on board. But just, you know, the sheer scale, the size, you know, we had an amazing tour, saw everything, I think, you know, pretty much. And, wow, what a impressive bit of war machine.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think the more you think about it, the more impressive it gets. When you consider the detail of how they designed it, and then putting it together and making sure it all works, it's an astonishing thing.
Yeah.
I mean,
I still don't know how they float.
So the Invincible-class carriers, which was Illustrious, Invincible and Ark Royal, were around about 600 feet long. And this was just shy of 1,000 feet long, which, you know, you go, oh, that's only 400 feet more. But, you think of the scale in terms of the fact that it's a massive ship anyway, to have, you know, that effectively 40% more, you know, hanging out the back, and also the width of it as well. It was, you know, the just up until the center line of the runway, I think they said, didn't they, was the whole width of the Invincible class carrier, and that was just up to the center line. It was just enormous.
Bloody you get a vague idea of the size of it, wouldn't you? We were talking about this, JB, on board when we saw the Queen Elizabeth rugby team about to do a bit of touch on the flight deck. If you got three rugby or football pitches side by side, you know, go down your local park, if you got something that big, that's the size of the the surface of the flight deck. But then that doesn't give you any idea that, you know, it was funny watching JB walk sideways in the middle of the deck just because of how flipping high up you are.
Oh God,
on the side of this thing.
Tell you what, I could not serve on that thing. The heights, it feels like you're in constant danger. So we walked up the ramp. I was like, I'm not having this one bit. It's just it was too high. And then it's little things when you descend down the steps towards the edge of the carrier, you stand on a grate. And I don't know how it was. It 40 foot below, and there's some water. I'm like, this is god awful. So
we all went on the carrier, and by a fairly long stretch, rugby playing JB sort of towers above us, and is he's a fairly big unit, and yet it was very interesting. I think I tweeted a photo of him looking decidedly worried.
Not
behind the three
heights.
Of us grinning on the ramp.
You normally can't stop him talking. Yeah, he was quiet all the way through.
I was
advancing
up that ramp about an inch at a time. Just a little bit. It's just a sheer drop, isn't it? But it's okay because the contractors told me there were some nets. I'm like, I don't want to ever meet those. I don't want to see the nets. Not interested.
Well, right. So imagine, JB, operating an aeroplane. So the aeroplanes will be chained down in heavy seas, but they'll still be operating. They'll be chained down in heavy seas, and the boys that they're called the chockheads that work the aeroplanes and marshal the aeroplanes, as well as the engineers, will be on the flight deck in that weather. In those seas, marshalling aeroplanes and the complexity of that carrier and having both helicopters and fast air on there, getting them on and off. It is huge. And not just the fact that, those guys are working in those conditions. I have to say, to see it and have had the privilege of operating on a carrier and see it and being part of that is just, it's awe-inspiring to see.
Well, I mean,
there's plenty of videos out there, JB, that you can see where the guys have to, Dunk's mentioned it before, where you have to follow the marshallers, you absolutely follow what they're telling you to do. And it might be, depending on where the nose wheel is on your aeroplane, that your cockpit's hanging over the edge of that thing.
I mean, we saw it, on a nice, bright, sunny day on the deck, and it was all quite jovial. But you sort of start to understand why it's so important that these people are as professional as they are. It's a dangerous place. It's a really dangerous place.
And that's why so few navies in the world can operate aircraft carriers successfully. Just on the size thing, it's interesting. Parky called it a war machine there. But, JB, what do you think as far as a sort of, extension, a manifestation of global Britain when that thing rolls into a port somewhere around the world? It's pretty impressive, right?
It won't just be that. It'll be a destroyer. It'll be a fleet replenishment ship. It'll be all sorts of things. Yeah, it's so big that you don't appreciate the size. I mean, you stand on that deck and you have nothing to compare it to. It dwarfs everything around it.
I was surprised how big the hangar was, that, and obviously we've got, we call it the lift, you can get a couple of F-35s, can you, or three of them up and down at the same time, and they then just wheel into the hangar. But that space, the deck below, it was as big almost as the space above, and that with 35 F-35s inside it would just look awesome. It would be extraordinary when that thing is heaving with helicopters and jets. It will be amazing.
Yeah,
but you have to think, right? So I'm going to sort of hark back to someone that we've spoken about many times on the podcast, which is Eric Winkle Brown and his exploits. So, the most prolific test pilot of all time. And he started on aircraft carriers. And the first carrier that he served on, he told me, was a converted German banana boat where they
That's
just
right, yes.
chopped the top off it, and that it didn't have any superstructure. It was just a flat surface on the top, and they had martlets, and I think he said they had 6, maybe 8 martlets, which were tied down to the back of it, and that's where they engineered the aeroplanes. You know, they didn't have any lifts, they didn't have any of that. So what are we talking, sort of 70 or 80 years ago, that's where we were. And now we're in a situation where they have not only, I mean, as you said, Park, you know, the logistics of it. You think, well, you can't just put 35 F-35s on there. 35 F-35s, but and you know, a number of helicopters. You've got to be able to engineer them, so you've got to have you know, engine rooms where you can go and service engines, take them out, put them in, cranes,
workshops,
you know, everything, and everything to completely be self-sufficient at sea. And as we, you know, we suffered previously with the carrier that we had, because as aircraft were developed, they didn't develop them with the carrier in mind, and therefore sometimes, so for instance, I can't remember the exact details, but I can't remember if it was a Chinook or a Sea King, but you couldn't take the rotor head off, or you couldn't fit it in the hangar Chinook. Of the Illustrious class. So that, you know, the engineering problems that they had were huge, whereas this, you know, everything fits in and everything is thought about.
Yeah. Do they generally, you know, if you weren't flying for a week, for example, would you generally put the aircraft downstairs, if you know what I mean, rather than let them sit out in the sort of the lashing rain and the, you know, the sea spray and stuff like that?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they might, if they didn't have room for whatever reason, you know, and that may have been the case previously, then they would just chain them down on deck.
But they'd like to try and get them, you know, because you can imagine, it's a bit like, you know, we hang around typhoons, didn't we? You know, every night you wheel them in just so they don't get full of water kind of thing.
Yeah, but, yeah.
And that's not even salt water.
I seem to recall the Falklands, you know, the task force, weren't the Harriers just left outside when they sailed down? Maybe they were so full, you know, the ships.
No, that's exactly what it is. It was so full. And that's the other aspect, isn't it? Is you're not just, Dunk's talked through the difficulties of operating a flight deck. You're also sailing that massive ship around the place. So whether it's engine rooms, whether it's the galley, the stores that you talked about, the sailors doing their jobs. We went past where they kept the slightly big ropes to tie up an aircraft carrier along the alongside there.
Yeah.
All of these sort of things, so the coordination between, and this is what we get into, isn't it, with the guys we interviewed up in Flyco. The coordination between the flying aspect and the sailing, the Navy aspect of it is pretty amazing.
Yeah, that is amazing. And do you know, that really hit home to me, because I'd never really thought of how an aircraft carrier, all the bits are comprised. But effectively, you've got the captain in, you know, the sailing and all that. And it sounds a little bit like, sounds a little bit disrespectful almost. But what you've got in the crew is basically people managing the facility, and then the war fighting is done effectively by the people that manage the aircraft, and then you've got another layer of people coming on who are the battle staff, who then manage all the other ships, including the aircraft carrier, from the aircraft carrier. It's not just simply you have a crew and that's it.
Yeah, and I think help me out if I get these numbers wrong, boys, because I'm sure God is, well, probably you, Park, as well, will remember these. But it was the crew on board was 800, I think they said.
Yes.
800 was your ship's company. And then when they embarked, both fast and rotary air on board, as well as the, you know, I guess they'd call that the carrier air group and all the people that support that, that then went up to 1,500. Is that right? 1,500?
Yeah, yeah, it was 1,500.
So 800 to 15. So you now got 1,500 people on board that thing. Everything. We were lucky enough to have lunch in the wardroom, which, again, I just, you know, it brought back the sounds and the smells of the carrier exactly the same as when I was on board Illustrious, and there's something sort of weirdly comforting about that, and you go, oh, yeah, I remember this. It sort of feels homely almost. I don't know if, you know, because clearly you guys hadn't been on it before. I don't know what your impressions of it was, but, you know, even so, you have the stewards there that service, and the way of life at sea is, again, just a very different. It's very difficult to explain, but it's a very different way of life, and it's fascinating to see.
Now, you just mentioned the crew. Let's see if you're paying attention. What size, because we did ask this, what size is the crew on something like a Nimitz-class carrier? Just to put it into perspective.
See, I think that was about 5,000 or something, wasn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah,
yeah. With the air wing embarked, so it's about 2,500-3,000 without the air wing, and then you put another couple of thousand on with the air wing.
Exactly.
Unbelievable. A ship of the same size.
Yeah. I mean, what we're looking at there is just the effects of automation and building a carrier from scratch.
Yeah. I think you're exactly right.
Now, there is...
This is a little bit bigger, but not much, is it?
Yeah, 70,000 to 90,000, something like that.
Has it got more draft or something?
Is that the floaty bit?
I think so.
The floaty bit, yeah. Floaty bit is the... Now, here is something which...
You can tell I'm in carrier-enabled power projection. Now,
here is something which you're going to find completely boring, right? But I found utterly fascinating. Because I don't really know what you guys get up to on a day-to-day basis, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's similar to this. So, at one point, we were told... to put our phones in a little lockbox, and we went into these two rooms. And this to me was the best part of the tour, because I get to understand exactly what people do. So you've got one room with what I can only describe as basically a risk table and a map, and that's what the aircraft carrier would do on that day. Is that broadly correct?
Yeah, so that was... We were talking about this on Saturday, weren't we? So you had the two different rooms, and one is doing the long-range planning, and one is doing the short-range planning, because that long-range planning is really important. Where the ship's sailing compared to remember, the ship is there to deliver that air power and sea power, but deliver that air power where it needs to be. So that longer-term plan is really important, but there'll also be a demand on those aeroplanes.
Yes.
So the captain has to, and the one-star... have to get that carrier group into the right place. Once they're in the right place, they then need to navigate it correctly so that you've got wind over the deck and you know when you're flying. And that's when it then transfers to that day-by-day schedule where you're now, right, here are our flying windows during the day and the night, so that the ship's staff and the ship's navigator know that they need to be on a particular course and bearing, whatever it happens to be, depending on weather of the day. Because you can imagine, you know, if you're... collecting aircraft, you know, you're going through a landing serial and you're sailing into wind, ain't so good if you've got an island in the way and you're going to have to break off, turn left, and those aeroplanes that are short of fuel have to now do something else. A little bit easier with F-35s vertically landing than it is in a Nimitz class when they're, you know, hitting the deck at 130 knots. But that was the difference in the planning, you know, that longer term, long range planning for the ship, understanding where they're going, what they're doing, what the flying schedule is likely to look like, when are those flying windows, and they can then... run the crew around that compared to the daily flying schedule, which is really important to the guys that we spoke to.
So you've got your daily flying schedule, and then in the next room you've got an identical table where you're doing the long-range planning, as God has said, and this is where it really gets interesting. In a brief, most mornings, you get the various air squadrons come in, and they get briefed on what they're doing and also of the things that they're going to do in the following days. They go away, tell me if I'm getting this wrong, and then these air squadrons come back with various plans, which are then accepted for the next day's planning. Is that correct?
Yeah, pretty much.
So if you want to get far in the RAF or the Navy or whatever it may be, is it the person that gets the most ideas sort of accepted for the various plans on a day-to-day basis? Because I'm imagining that a lot of this stuff is going back to squadrons. They're coming up with plans, then taking them back up, higher up the chain.
No, because it's a big team and it's a big puzzle as to how to fit it all together.
Yes.
So it's not a competition as to who can get the most serials in, because a squadron itself will have a number of different things that they need to achieve in just normal flying training, as well as required to do an operation. So it might be that someone needs a night deck landing or whatever it happens to be. So they have to try and fit that into their schedule and say, hey, can we night fly in the next night flying period, please? And it might be that some of the air traffic controllers on board need to do a particular amount of control. So they'll ask the squadrons, hey, during this period, can we have 5 instrument approaches towards the ship? It's that sort of thing.
Now, if a plan is accepted, this gets even more amazing, because they can practice it on simulators on board, which, again, is just amazing.
Yeah, and that is where we are different to any other aircraft carrier in the world at the moment. The ability to embark essentially two containers with four F-35 cockpits inside that you can run off and run your simulators, whether that is practicing emergencies, you know, the sort of day-to-day stuff that makes you current, or, which I think is more important, is the mission rehearsal of a task that you are, that you might be tasked to carry out in the next few days, next week or so. You know, you can trial tactics in there that you know, against particular threat systems, those sorts of things. So you're constantly learning throughout the cruise.
It is astonishing. I mean, Duncan, can you just put into context how important that would have been, or how much use that would have been in your Harrier days when you're flying off a carrier?
It's difficult to say, actually. It's a tricky one because, you know, the mission that's being flown is so different from an F-35 to what we were doing in a Harrier. You know, some of the time, you know, just dropping dumb bombs, you know, and again, you know, low-level sorties, because we were sort of going from the Cold War era with that aeroplane and trying to then step up to medium level and close air support operations. And then if you... So, you know, for close air support, would you need to do mission rehearsal? Could you even do mission rehearsal? Probably not. You know, what you could do is you could go and do your simulator sorties, which is a nice to have. But I think, you know, the fifth generation fighter that F-35 is, you know, that mission simulation in what it's going to do, I think, you know, is all important. But it's a very different mission to what the Harrier did.
But even that close air support, of course you can practice it, because you can practice speaking. You know, the simulator instructor can be a terminal air control party, you know, a forward air controller doing something, and you can practice what you're going to write down, how you're going to use your weapon system, you know, put your kit a bit more simple in the Harrier. You could give yourself clouds and you know, targeting problems when it
comes to dropping weapons. I agree, but you were kind of doing that every day anyway. That's the thing. You actually, there wasn't that restriction on flying. We were flying our asses off.
When you were at Witteringdunk, did you ever use the sim for tactical stuff, or was it just for emergencies?
No, you do some tactical stuff as well, but
so,
not.
So you could kind of do the same thing then, maybe on the ship, I don't know.
I guess you could have done, but the point I'm trying to put across is I don't know how much use that would have been, because, you know, you'd have done that preparation before you embarked, and then you were doing the missions on dip, you know.
Now, we've seen...
Do you see what I mean?
Well, we've seen the software, haven't we, at Farnborough, before it obviously all closed down, where actually you could put an F-35 in the air, in fact, any airframe in the air, and then you could get a guy in a simulator, and you could basically formate up, you could do everything else because of the heads-up display on the F-35. It'd be like you were flying with another aircraft. I can imagine that being incredibly powerful for training.
Oh, yeah, definitely. The live, virtual, and constructive, that's called. So you've got a live entity, a virtual entity, and the constructive part is you construct the world around them. So the world is your oyster when it comes to that sort of stuff. And that's the stuff we're developing at the moment that is really, really interesting.
Isn't it?
And will just make better fighter pilots in the future. But you've always got to balance it with what Dunk said at the beginning. You know, if kids, I call them kids, that's probably disrespectful, but the youngsters coming through training today are... If they just want to fly aeroplanes, you have to let people fly aeroplanes. And so it's why we call it a balance, you know, a live synthetic balance. You know, you still have to be live flying. You can't do this all in the sim and then break out a real aeroplane the first time you do it, because you cannot simulate being short of fuel coming back to a ship land.
Well, you can. You can simulate it, but you won't get the fear factor of when you are actually coming back.
But that's exactly what I mean, Doug.
Yeah.
You know, you cannot simulate that, the panic rising in your throat.
Not that any of us panic. We're all, well, no. Maybe the Brave Air Commodore does, but the rest of us are absolutely steely calm at all times.
Doug, you were just sick a little bit then, weren't you?
I did puke a bit.
Well, you know, I think we've witted on enough, because we've got an interview from Queen Elizabeth herself, HMS Queen Elizabeth, in the Flyco with Ed Phillips and James Blackmore. So, enjoy it.
Ed, could you just introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about where we are and what we're doing?
Hello, I'm Commander Ed Phillips. I am Commander Air of HMS Queen Elizabeth, colloquially known as Wings, and has been so since the first Commander's Air in the 1920s. So it's a long-standing sort of position. My job is on behalf of the captain, I have conduct of...
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Aviation on board HMS Queen Elizabeth, so all the air activity that goes on from this aircraft carrier will be supervised by me.
Excellent. And we're also joined by a ship's captain, one of the captains, James Blackmore.
So, good afternoon. Yeah, thank you. James Blackmore, I'm the UK Carrier Strike Group, Carrier Air Wing and Strike Warfare Commander. Which sounds incredible.
Longer than your title. I'm
getting the coat. But for short, CAG. There you go. That gives you nice and simple. But and in effect, once Ed, as Wings, gets the jets off the deck, or the helicopters off the deck, they then almost transfer over to myself for the operational mission, if you like, and the effect, which is the carrier strike effect, which is what we've got this carrier for.
Oh, that's really interesting. I didn't realise that. So can you just explain a little bit about the interplay between you two then?
Well, do you know, we're going to probably find more of that out this autumn, really, because as part of operational tests as we go out to Westland 19 in America, we're going to start to tease out those relationships. But in many ways, a way of thinking about it is Ed owns the aircraft when they're on the deck. He safely gets them weaponed, fuelled, and ready for launch, gets them off the deck, launches those aircraft, gets them away from the carrier control zone, or the CCZ, at which point they kind of come my responsibility. So we have a sort of symbiotic relationship in some ways where we work together, and then I take those aircraft and put them into the operational mission to deliver the effects that we want to give.
Is it right to say, then, that Ed, in the film Top Gun, and both of them have just gone, oh, what the hell is he talking about here? You're the one who gets coffee spilt all over you.
That's right, yeah.
And Blackers, are you the bald-headed guy who...
Smoking cigars.
Sending you to Top Gun.
So we know who these guys are.
Let's baseline it.
What would you be in that movie?
Funny, because they look almost exactly the same.
Well, that's cool. So, you know, that really does demonstrate, actually, that the fact that, you know, on a carrier you have that control zone, and it is, you know, it's an airport, and it's got everything from it. We're stood in air traffic right now, from, you know, people controlling, taxiing the aircraft on the deck, getting airborne, you know, that sort of close-in control, doing approaches to the ship. But then once you're outside of that, just like any sort of land base, then Blackers, you're sticking, you know, you're telling them that on this particular day they're doing a strike mission or a suppression of enemy air defences or anything like that.
Exactly that. And you know, the beauty of an aircraft carrier is obviously it moves around the globe, and you know, this up to 500 miles a day. So we're never quite sure where we'll be. Obviously, we're planning to be places. So the environment that we're operating in, the airspace, will change continuously, as will the operational output. So, it's a constant challenge, but that's the beauty of having something this size with this number of aircraft.
Right, now, if I've got this right, I think I have, you'd both flown previously with Dunk, is that right?
We both have.
And so does that mean that you're both originally RAF men?
No.
Right, okay, so just give me...
That's a very short answer, isn't it?
No. Give me a bit of background.
That's one of the worst questions you could have ever asked him.
They both...
He thought he was right.
Yeah. We're both in the Fleet Air Arm.
Okay.
So the Naval Aviation Arm of the Royal Navy. The reason we have flown with Dunk is we were both part of an organisation called Joint Force Harrier, which was a joint Royal Navy and Royal Air Force organisation operating the Harriers from land and sea in the past. And a model similar to that is when we go forward to now the Lightning Force that embarks on board these ships. That is a joint Royal Navy and Royal Air Force organisation in a sort of similar vein, with pilots from both services operating to the same procedures.
Yeah, so the Royal Navy, the UK in general, hasn't had a carrier for a very, very long time until this one. The Harriers disappeared quite some time ago. It must have taken an awful lot of faith on behalf of both of you two to sort of hang around and make sure that you got to this point and this all came into fruition.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, 2009-10 was a pretty dark time for you and I, wasn't it? When, along with both Air Force and Navy pilots, you know, none of us really knew what the future looked like. It was a leap of faith to get to this point. Some people chose to take different paths. Some of us stuck around. Bloody glad we did.
Yeah.
Both Ed and I got a chance to go and fly F-18s in America in that interim time, whilst we didn't have a carrier-based aircraft to keep our skills up and understand how to operate a ship of this size. And then we both find ourselves back here now, you know, almost 10 years to the day since that decision was taken to scrap the carrier and the Harrier, here delivering F-35s from Queen Elizabeth.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. Could you just tell me a little bit about, you know, how did you go about making sure that you maintained your skills in that huge gap?
I think, you know, you're absolutely right to call it a huge gap. When we were, in 2010, when we were looking at that, we were quite concerned, and actually a large part of this is down to the thanks to the US Navy and the US Marine Corps and the French Navy as well, in terms of recognising the importance of having this capability within the United Kingdom, and therefore inviting us to come and operate with them on board their aircraft carriers. That's not just for aircrew, but that's also for flight deck handlers, intelligence officers, navigators, etc., across the board. And I think that actually the real paradox of this all is that because that program has been so successful, we almost find ourselves in a position where we are more experienced in operating aircraft at sea than we might have been otherwise, which, as well as it's been, you know, for those of us involved, a huge adventure and a real privilege at the same time.
So it's right, we're in a better place now than we arguably would have been had we kept those carriers and Harriers going forward. And that will sound quite odd to a lot of people, but actually taking a break from it, taking that bold decision early, making sure we work with our other, you know, colleagues in other services and other navies to get where we are. So it's a good outcome.
So if I was a US Navy, if I was in the US Navy and I came on board the ship when you're up and running, would it largely be the same, or would we notice some substantial differences?
There will be elements that are the same and elements that are very different as well. I think, you know, the way we operate here is not the way we always did business in our old little Harrier carriers. It's not the way the Americans do it in their carriers or the French do it. It's taking elements from all of those and trying to take that forwards. Obviously, the main one from an American strike carrier pilot coming on board here is that we operate short takeoff and vertical landing, which abbreviates to STOVL, as our mode of operation, whereas they use catapults and arrestor wires to launch and recover those aeroplanes. That's the main one, but there are all sorts of other changes in terms of the fact we have two islands, the island being the term we use in carriers for the superstructure above above the flight deck, as opposed to other ships. Let's say take an American carrier or indeed Charles de Gaulle, or most carriers have only one.
So just to explain though, so we're now in the aft island, aren't
we?
So which is part of that superstructure. So Flyco that was described before, it's like it's a fantastic air traffic control tower, effectively, with brilliant visibility of the whole ship. But those two island superstructures, I think JB asked before, maybe it was Parky, why are there two?
It comes down to the basis of the design, and I think there are two main reasons for it. One is to do with propulsion, and the other is to do with resilience. So, broadly speaking, she is an electrically propelled ship. So she is driven forwards by electric motors, and the rest of the machinery is effectively a large power station to provide that electricity.
But so it's green power. The environmentalists would be absolutely delighted.
There is power. The power comes from diesel generators and gas turbines. The gas turbines being marine Trents, so based on the same Trent as you would find in a Boeing 777, for example. They provide the right amount of power for not just the engines, but also for the lights we see, all of the other services around. What that means, though, is because you don't need to tie them all to...
How many of those engines?
Trents. We have four diesel generators and two gas turbines.
Okay.
Now, that comes into the island because the positioning of them is such that they because they're just generating electrical power through an alternator, you can put them where you like in the ship. And by having them underneath, where we would have our uptakes and our downtakes, it means that we can separate them. You can have less space taken up by that machinery, allows us to operate more aeroplanes as a result, but it does require two elements coming up above the flight deck.
Okay.
And as a result of that, we have the two towers, the two islands. That also gives us better survivability because we have a redundancy should one or the other take damage. And we're standing here in Flyco, the flying control, but if we look to the forward island where the bridge is, the navigation bridge, in one corner of that, we could use that should we need to as a secondary Flyco.
Yeah.
And vice versa, at the forward end of this island, the aft island, there is a secondary bridge effectively for should they need it.
Even that secondary, as I look now towards the forward end of the ship, and I can see that second Flyco that Ed was just talking about. Even that looks significantly better as a Flyco than the Flyco we had on Illustrious.
Massively. I mean, the whole thing's a huge step forward.
Yeah, yeah.
This carrier designed entirely around the jet.
Yeah.
If we're honest, designed around 36 of them. So we're the only carrier in the world that's been designed specifically for a fifth generation F-35 Lightning aircraft.
Yeah. Just going back to the Flybix, I didn't realise, you're uniquely, I guess both, that you've done the V-Stol Harrier, but you've also done, Ed, you were saying 200 plus cat and traps in the F-18 and a year at sea.
Yeah, so, about 100 for me.
That's unbelievable. So you've got boys that have spent years Harrier off of the ship, but also F-18s as well. So, you've seen it both sides. Really can, the pros and cons of both.
You've actually both been... You know, when you look back, as you were saying before, and you look at the demise of the Sea Harrier, which then came to the demise of the GR9 at the end there in 2010, you could have looked at that and gone, flippin' heck, those boys are having a hard time. But actually, the experience, and particularly the naval experience that you've gleaned operating Sea Harrier and then GR9 off the carrier... And then to come cats and traps to this is huge, isn't it?
It is huge.
Well, full circle, almost, isn't it?
It is a little bit. Yeah, absolutely.
It's been a wonderful adventure and great experience to take forward, that's for sure. Yeah.
Do you, the way the US Navy operates, where it is all about the deck cycle because it has to be, we had a short discussion earlier about the fact that they'll have F-18 tankers in order to top people up so they can make their slot times, all of that sort of stuff, or to top them up once they've taken off. Do you see an advantage of the way that we are going to operate because we're slightly more flexible when it comes to that?
I think you've hit the word there. It's the flexibility that you get with a V-Stol platform, which is one of the advantages. There are some disadvantages as well, but I think the we'll be able to have probably a longer flying window in a 24-hour period, where we'll be able to generate fast jets for a longer period of time throughout the day and night, which I think is one of our advantages.
Is that because you won't have to reset catapults? And what's the reason for that? Why? What is?
Is it just quicker bringing a jet in for the soul than a?
It's part of that. The way the ships are manned are such that we have the watch rotation to enable us to have the flight deck fully manned all the time. Now, that's not saying an American carrier couldn't do that for a very short period of time, but they're not scaled for that for the longer term.
So the majority of the people that work on board will work 8 hours on, 8 hours off, 8 hours on, continuously for the whole time we're at sea. So in essence, we've always got people up able to deliver flying. So from a helicopter point of view, it's reasonable to expect this to be flying helicopters at any time throughout that 24-hour period. We'll probably throttle slightly back on the jet just because of the tempo and the number of people, but no, we should be able to deliver something of that order of magnitude, which is great news.
One of the other points that is not immediately obvious as we stand here, but when we're operational, we're not going to sail with them in the next few weeks, but the use of simulation for the flying wing on board is enormous. We walk through the hangar deck, and there's actually two slots in the hangar deck there for what are big ISO containers. So for anyone listening, you know, the sorts of containers that you get on the back of a ship, on the back of a truck that you see driving down the motorway. And each one of those has two F-35 cockpits in. So you've got a linked F-35 four-ship that means that as soon as you sail, actually, arguably, I was going to say you could maintain your currency in terms of high-end missions and that sort of thing. Actually, you could get better.
You link those sims with the boys flying as well?
No, not at the moment. Okay. That's an aspiration for the future. But it just means that, you know, you can fly and be doing your mission and doing that sort of stuff. Also, you can be in the simulator, or alternatively, you could be in the simulator practicing mission rehearsing the sortie that you're about to go and do, which is flipping brilliant.
It's a huge benefit. It's unique. No one else is doing that right now. We think you'll realise some huge benefits. You know, we know in the military that a lot of our flying practice, if you like, just to keep currency or understand how to do things and your tactics, will be done in the simulator. Historically, that's all been done ashore. But to be able to take that with us to sea, and do you know what? As the CAG for the air wing, we've got a really gnarly mission coming up in, say, 4 days' time. To be able to go and rehearse that as with the four pilots that are going to go and fly that mission in the representative threat environment, what an absolute bonus that is.
And you've flown the F-35 Sims, I guess, just to have experience of what it's like to land an F-35 on the carrier. Piloty question, but now, Harrier, F-18 and F-35, in terms of adrenaline and heartbeats, how would you rate that difficulty and between those three jets?
Without having flown the F-35, I'll hold back on commenting from what is otherwise, you know, the simulator. But I think if you were to compare a Harrier and an F-18, Super Hornet in particular, the later model of F-18 that I flew, the more modern one, the capability the F-18 had is far greater than the Harrier had. And as a machine in which to go to war, it's I'd choose that.
F-35 like, isn't it?
It is. And all of that, the way it integrates its sensor information, the way.
But just in terms of pure piloting, coming back, you know, I've got to now land on this ship.
In a way, I think, you know, in a way, I felt I flew a Harrier, I operated a Hornet to a certain, because it has that level of sort of fly by wire. You're kind of a 98% voting member in actually what it's going to do, whereas I think the crisp nature of a Harrier's much more mechanical linkage controls meant that I think it was from a pilot's point of view.
I'm sensing more heartbeats in the Harrier.
I think so.
I think especially night. I think night V-stall in a Harrier. Whoa. Was probably
interesting. So worse than landing an F-18 on a deck?
I think so. You're set up for success when you land an F-18 at night. You start off on the glide path, and broadly, the energy state of that aircraft just stays the same all the way down to touchdown. You fly 144 or so knots all the way down to touchdown.
Smack.
65 feet above the sea. You're following some pretty much single-pointed light source. You fly down, and two things are going to happen. Hopefully, both of them involve hitting the deck. You either then stop very quickly because you've taken an arrest arrestor wire, or you bounce and get airborne again and take the bolter. So in some
have
ways,
you had to do that.
Oh yeah, obviously.
It's just that Ed hadn't. Yeah. So.
No. whereas with the Harrier, you know, as some of you know that we're talking about, a lot of us have flown Harrier here. That the energy state of that aircraft, you're going from something that's wing-borne to purely thrust-borne as you come in and land. So. I think the night landing V-stop wise for a Harrier is probably a harder game than the F-18. But you know what, the launches are interesting because the ramp launch in a Harrier, I mean, that's phenomenal fun to go up the ramp and you go from some extremely short distances. You know, Harrier was 200 feet from the ramp edge, 350 feet in in a F-35.
And so just to describe that to people, the 200 feet on Illustrious was as the ramp started to go up. So that you had no level deck, you literally lined up at the start of the ramp, and off you went.
Yes.
And as a non-Harrier mate, and JB, we're the only ones that spent a lot of time on a ship, I remember going on Illustrious, and it's a bit like standing here now, and it is utterly amazing, but standing on that 200 spot, whatever they called it, the two spots, and looking and imagining you had to, just with your own thrust, get airborne. It just beggared belief. And even the 300 spot, how an F-35 will get airborne in that distance.
It's incredible.
It is incredible.
Yeah, so we, and we can perhaps talk a bit about some of the testing we did last year, but just to come back to your adrenaline question, I'm going to give you three orders of where I thought the level of violence was in the cockpit.
Yeah.
I think the third most violent thing I've ever done is launching an F-18 off a catapult. That's a pretty violent experience.
Yeah.
Second most violent experience is landing an F-18. First most violent experience is ejecting. So
okay.
If you want to put it in those orders of where things
get
interesting.
Have you done all three?
Yeah.
All right.
So I think I can comment.
You're the one.
The level of just G-force and violence that you experience in the cockpit, and it is like violence, isn't it? It's a bit like just being beaten up when you're taking the arrested landing or a catapult.
But in a very exciting way, I imagine.
A fully loaded Super Hornet is some 66,000 pounds in weight, so that's 30 odd tons. And it'll go from 0 to 160 odd knots in the space of a couple of seconds.
And stop from 144
second.
So
the amount of energy imparted and then taken away is just phenomenal.
So what is the optimum takeoff level of the F-35 on
350 feet?
It's nothing, is it?
I'm just looking at the 300 model.
To put that into context, the deck itself goes back to all the way to 850 feet.
So here's the point, JB. So having seen an aircraft carrier for the first time, as you look out from what is an amazing view out over used to airfields is still a massive piece of real estate. What are your first impressions looking out?
Do you know what? It's so vast that you don't really appreciate the scale. Because what's a football field like 100 meters?
Yeah.
It's absolutely enormous.
I mean, this is it's hard to quantify the size when you look at it, but it's about 900 feet long. It's about 210 feet across the beam. It's 4.5 acres is another way of describing it, or it's 16,000 square metres. Either way, it's a lot shorter than the runway on land. Traditionally a land runway that will operate at RF Marham, 8,000 feet. We're down to a max 900 feet here, but actually reality is we'll only use about 350, 400 feet of it.
Is that irrespective of what load the F-35 is carrying?
In part, there will be times when we need to launch further aft along the runway, but for a standard combat loadout in standard weather conditions, internal weapons, as we know, it's got an internal weapons bay, it'll tend to go from 350 to 450 feet without too much problem. The ship will drive into wind and we'll put about 20 knots of wind over the deck, which obviously helps a little bit, but it doesn't, it will go even in those light winds. It's phenomenal.
We were chatting to Ed earlier, and I had no idea about this, but just how clever the F-35 is. So as it gets airborne, it knows when it's hitting the ramp, and then it does some clever thrust.
Yeah, well, a ramp launch in general, and this is no different, the basic principle between a Harrier and an F-35, but it's much more automated in the F-35, is such that you are very much like going off a humpback, going too fast over a humpback bridge in a car.
Never done.
You are below the flying speed of the aeroplane when you leave the bows of the ship. But the fact that you've got a ballistic throw The idea is, and the calculations are shown, that when you reach the apogee of that ballistic throw, that's when you're at flying speed and you carry on flying and flying away. What that does, though, is very simply through a piece of what is no more than a cleverly designed piece of metal, which doesn't really require much in the way of any maintenance or manning, is it gives you an effective length of launch which is so much greater. And that's the reason why we're able to launch from, say, 350 feet. And you could then say, well, what's the rest of it for? But that gives us the flexibility to operate a far greater number of aeroplanes than we were able to operate before, and different types of helicopters.
That front
as well.
Engine, Ed, forgive my ignorance, yeah. The hover engine.
The lift,
that is kicking in as you're just launching up that. So it's not there. So in a split second, just clever stuff.
It is. And the lift fan, when the jet taxis out, it converts into a stovel mode. So you've seen the videos, all those doors open up, the lift fan lid opens up. The lift fan then engages, a big clutch drives from the main engine into the into a clutch, into the lift fan, spools that lift fan up, and so the lift fan and the main engine are both running as the jet goes up the deck, and then it increases the thrust as it needs it. But it's phenomenal.
Yeah, I guess you want to know that that lift fan's going prior to that.
It is, but it works, and as we were saying earlier on, Ed and I both flew Sea Harriers, and there was no apogee in a Sea Harrier going off the ramp. It just went off dead flat if you were lucky. Some days it was flat and a bit down, which was always a bit of an eye-opener. GR9, bigger wing, bigger engine, you've got a much greater performance. The jet really sort of starts to look like it was climbing away.
Particularly with a big engine.
Yeah, the big engine was huge.
Yeah. I never flew the big engine jet. Did it make a difference?
Yeah. Huge. Rocket ship. Huge. Whereas the F-35 just shoots off. It's incredible. Yeah. Now, we did some testing last year where it was deliberately, we took it to the absolute min distance that was calculated safe to do, just to give ourselves confidence. So we got some flat
see where the line is.
Yeah. But all that was really well worked out.
I was just going to say, about that testing that you did last year, I think we've mentioned already that it was developmental testing. Yep. So the first time the jet was coming to land on the ship, so very much test pilots, very much instrumented equipment, that side of things. This year it is frontline pilots doing it. In the next few weeks, it's the frontline pilots doing it.
So we sail in days view now to go across to America. Not with the jets initially. We've got some other trials the ship's going to do. It's going to get itself very hot just to make sure we can operate in hot climates.
Feels very hot.
It does now, I know. It's going to go
30 degrees C to do it.
We're going to do some rotary wing flying trials just because we need to expand the envelope of helicopters operating on here. And then we're going to pick the jets up early October.
You'll just come back a bit, so they'll just launch.
They're going to fly out and meet us there. So they'll fly out from the UK and from Edwards Air Force Base. Two separate locations where we've got UK F-35s. Yeah. They're going to meet us probably in South Carolina, Marine Corps Air Station Beaufort, and they'll launch onto us once we're out at sea.
Amazing.
But to go back to your point, then yes, it's all about now looking at how we operationalise use the aircraft in that operational concept. But it's not just about the ship as well, it's about all the ships that make the task creep up as well. So we're going with a destroyer, our Type 45 destroyer. We're going with a Type 23 anti-submarine warfare frigate as well. And the key thing, because the jet's proved itself already, it's been out, it's flown some operational shader missions as well, had a Cyprus. We've got to now make sure that everything it can do from a land base, we can do it at least as well, dare I say, if not even better, from the maritime and in the maritime. So it's got to be able to talk to all the other ships and still be able to deliver on that strike mission.
Now, you don't have a carrier air wing here, do you? It's a tailored strike group, is that correct?
So we do call it a carrier air wing.
Okay.
Yeah, we're not in what we... Sometimes the word tailored gets used, but it's very much a carrier air wing. It's all of those elements that come together to form the air wing. So right now, you're looking at the deck, no aircraft at all. As we sail later this week, helicopters from Royal Naval Air Station Yeovilton and Royal Naval Air Station Caldrose will join us, and that will be a mixture of Merlin Mark IIs, the anti-submarine warfare helicopters, Merlin Mark IVs, which we use for a number of roles, one of which is stores resupply, but also to look at things like joint personnel recovery and also the being able to put Royal Marines ashore. So we'll have those. We'll also have Wildcat, which is the modernised or the new variant of the Lynx helicopter, which will join us and be in our frigates and our tanker support ship as well. So we'll go with a initially rotary wing, air wing, and then when the jets come in, that will form up. And this is all steps towards what our final air wing will look like for the first deployment in 2021. where we'll have more helicopters and more jets.
So I guess my question, my follow-up question on that then is, who designs the air wing before you go? Do you guys get together with a pen and pencil and say, yeah, we want
So if it's wrong...
It was buckets.
How many people are we talking, by the way, on board when you sail?
So the ship, broadly, Ed, we're looking at about 800 or so people. The ship's company, 800.
And if you were tooled up with marines and pilots...
And everybody else, then we're looking closer to 1,500 people. So in the ship, about 1,500 people, and we're fully tooled up, ready to go, with an air wing, with rockets, and we'll have that this year.
So there's one there, but so with the ship... Essentially the similar size to a Nimitz class. Yeah. When you guys were sailing on deployment with the Americans, how many people inside that
had
an air wing?
Upwards of 5,000 people.
What?
Yeah, so there is a big difference there.
So to deliver the same effect.
Yeah, and I think the...
It's amazing.
And this is in a way, that the benefit we've had of being able to step back and take a fresh look at the way we design the ship. There's a huge amount of clever British engineering that has gone into the ship design as a whole, which enables us to do what we hope is, you know, a very similar level of operational output, but with a far fewer people on board, through the use of automation, particularly things like our weapons handling systems, etc., which are largely automated. Because the reality is, we just, you know, the Americans are very, very good at what they do. They are, you know, the world's leading carrier nation and have done it for some time. But we don't have the resources to be able to man ships to the way they do. And like, so I think, you know, this class of ship is actually very well thought through and is a really efficient dare I say, a very good value for money way to get through what we're trying to achieve.
Imagine that, 5,000 people.
Well, so just to put that into perspective a little bit, I think just the sort of the sense of history and privilege, actually, for us to come on board and stand here today. So, and there's all sorts of bits of history as we've arrived. So we came to the Ark Royal building. Is this the Ark Royal Quayside? Is that what this is called? Royal Jetty here. And here, as we look over our left shoulder, actually, we can see HMS Victory just over the way here. And here we are at the cutting edge of technology, and we've spoken about a few numbers there. I was reading a book called Erebus at the moment, which is about a Royal Naval ship that was then went on the Antarctic expeditions. Michael Palin wrote it. Yeah, the book club. There you go, straight in there. But it's in the
18. I didn't know you could read.
Yeah, I know, nor did I. Yeah, it's got lots of pictures. Lots of pictures.
Audiobook.
Now we got it. Okay.
But it talks about, so this the ship Erebus went off. It did a 4-year Antarctic expedition, but it was just over 100 feet long. And it had 160 people on board, and at the time, it was the cutting edge. But the sense of excitement that it describes of the whole nation of that voyage, and actually, we're stood up here on Flyco now, and we just watched what I think was the Portsmouth Cat come past, and the whole of the civilian, what must be a pleasure craft of some sort, was crammed with people all looking at what is this incredible aircraft carrier that we're lucky enough to be standing
pretty
on.
Pretty proud moment for you, wasn't it, when you set sail.
And now I think when we come back in December, the second one will be more than just a stern of us, HMS Prince of Wales. So we look at stern of us in December, there'll be another one of these. Now, that's a good photograph once. After that, the whole idea is we've got two, so that one's always out there doing the job, being ready to go to do the job. But you're right, it's great. I mean, the juxtaposition with HMS Victory just there is incredible.
Yeah, and we're looking actually down on one of the ferries coming, which just looks tiny. I was saying to Ed that, you know, we went into to Malta on Illustrious, and when we were there, one of these cruise liners came in and parked next to it, and it made Illustrious look tiny. But that won't be the case with Queen Elizabeth.
You've got a phone call to me?
I've got another. I'm good at the moment, but...
That's right. So, four of you here have served on Illustrious. Is it Illustrious or Invincible?
The Invincible class, of which there was Illustrious, Invincible, and Ark Royal.
Yeah.
So, just from your initial impressions then, gents, how would you compare the two?
It's difficult to say, to be honest. I mean, I got that same sense of excitement. I said to the guys, actually, just the smell as you come on board is like, well, I'm back on the carrier. And the hairs on the back of my neck went up. It is the most incredible environment to operate on, I found. It's just amazing. And the, you know, the guys have already spoken about the whole fleet concept, but the crew concept as well. And operating on a carrier, particularly in aviation, we call them the chockheads, the guys that marshalled us around the ship. The accuracy, you were absolutely at their disposal. You followed their command to the letter in terms of how they marshalled you around. Now, although the Queen Elizabeth here is clearly significantly bigger, it's got that same feel, that's, you know, of course, that same professionalism and that same focus to do a job of which the guys have just both described. So it's what it does for me is it makes me want to get back into an aeroplane and blast off.
Absolutely.
Again. Yeah.
And she's not bigger in order to provide more space for aircraft to aircraft. She's bigger and able to operate more aeroplanes and therefore have a greater effect. So this will become a busy deck, and those aircraft handlers out there will very much earn their money.
You've got a hell of a job, haven't
you?
Well, you as well here, sat there.
Yes, absolutely. We've
already got 40 minutes, so I'm going to ask you two similar but slightly different questions. I'll go for Blackers first. What are you most looking forward to when you embark the jets what's only basically a few months' time?
I think it's seeing more than the two we had last year, so we'll start to see an increase in number of jets, which is always a good thing. But it's about getting frontline pilots on here now and seeing that mixture of Royal Air Force and Royal Navy pilots operating from the deck of a UK carrier once more. That's going to be brilliant. And it will also be the first time a UK jet has landed on a carrier. So it's that sort of combination.
It's a lot of history there, isn't it?
Yeah, huge.
That's
good. Yeah, absolutely.
The last one would be, what is the biggest learning point which you've had so far, which you weren't necessarily expecting?
That's an interesting one. We are learning every single day. I can't put my finger on one in particular. I think the whole idea of us going this autumn is to do that operational test where we will get some things right, we will get some things wrong. The idea is that we learn from all of that and take it forward. I think overall, however, is the biggest learning point is a lot of the sort of myths that were washing around about how difficult it would be to operate F-35 at sea. It would be too loud, it would melt the deck, it would knock people over. Thankfully, have not been realised. You know, and I think we have actually proven last year, and we expected to carry on with that, you absolutely need to respect the aeroplane like you would any aeroplane, because it's producing a great deal of thrust and it is a noisy beast. But at the same time, that is entirely manageable, and I think this design is showing that the testament of designing that ship for the aeroplane is starting to show to bear fruit, I think, which is really.
And the Harrier
really
wasn't exactly quiet, was it?
No.
Hey, I've got a question. I'm sorry now, clearly, we all have fond memories not only of operating off the ship, but it was a very close knit community. It was a very social time, so we've all got fond memories of the wardroom and also the quarter deck. Now, the quarter deck on Illustrious was a fantastic place to be, at the back of the ship with the capstans there, teak decking there as we looked over, and we may have once or twice shared half a glass of wine, maybe half a gin and tonic, something like that. How's the quarter deck here on Queen Elizabeth?
I'm afraid that's one of the you hit on one of the problems with the design, shall we say, is that the quarter deck is not to the same standard as we had before.
Right.
But you do hit. You know, we have a very good wardroom. And I think we can think and laugh back at the good old memories, but actually, what I've been privileged to see in British and French and American carriers is the provision of that wardroom to allow that kind of social mingling across the ship and across every single department and every single squadron is really important. And I think for those of us who only know that, it kind of goes past you, but I think it's a really important way in which we get everybody on board, we understand everyone's roles, and I think it makes us a much more integrated and better whole ship's company as a result.
So final question. final question, because I know we're going to lose you, Blackers, in a bit. But we've not actually, and so we can't go into a huge amount of detail, but I guess we've been fortunate, the ones, the three of us that fly, in not having ejected over the years. And there's just a throwaway violence point that you make. Do you want to give us a couple of minutes?
Always good to end on you banging out. That's the finale.
How it came about, and would you recommend it?
To live, yes, because I wouldn't have done it if I hadn't used ejection seat. So Martin Baker ejection seat, but 19 years ago now, 2000, I was lining up on the land-based ramp in a Harrier, my fourth ever sort in a Harrier, the first time I was ever going to go off the ramp. Lined up to go at 250 feet, you can kind of guess what's coming next. Always really good on the acceleration to start off with, and then the engine failed about halfway up the ramp. The aircraft never achieved that flying speed that Ed talked about. I was in a two-seater with an instructor, and as we got to the top, it was very clear we were only doing 10 knots. We weren't going to fall backwards down the ramp. We were going to topple off and go in. So actually, in some ways, it was probably one of the worst crashes you've ever seen. But to stay in the aircraft would have been catastrophic.
Were you instructed to get
no, out? The old Harrier two-seater that I was flying then had no command ejection, and in fact I left before the instructor decided to go,
just kind of trickled off the top.
You'd have gone, it's about a 17-foot high ramp, so you'd have nosed, about a 30-odd G ejection to 150-odd.
And did you think about pulling the, was it a obvious conscious thought about pulling the handle, or did it just happen?
Obvious conscious thought, absolutely 100%. So we always do a takeoff and emergencies brief before launching, and that takeoff and emergencies brief saved my life, because one of the what-ifs was, what if the engine fails or the aircraft doesn't fly from the ramp? And it was very clear. So to pull the handle was a no-brainer, but it was a, I'm now going to eject, pull the handle.
And in slow-mo, can you remember every...
Absolutely every single bit of it. The whole lot. So seat firing, canopy going.
Which was in about a second.
Was it miniature detonation cord in that, Harry?
It was, yeah.
For the benefit of the people listening, both of you...
I think it's just one today.
There's a small explosive sort of zigzag down the canopy. It is plastic explosive that detonates so that the seat can come through. Typhoon or an Typhoon, it's just like the F-14 that you see in Top Gun, where it's charges around the canopy that take the whole canopy off. But so you went through the canopy.
Absolutely. Remember the canopy going, remember me going through it, remember watching the jet get smaller because I foolishly kept my eyes open, watched my instructor eject out underneath me, and then...
Are you meant to keep your eyes open?
It's probably advisable to close them, but...
You had your eyes.
So it's protected.
I think it shows a bit of capacity, to be honest.
Not really, stupidity. And then, under a parachute, 3 seconds later,
So there's the thing there. So at that apex... Did you think?
I can see my house from here.
I hope the chute opens.
I didn't think. No, that part never in my mind. It was
When you hit the floor, did you get straight back up, or did you take a few seconds?
No, I didn't. Just because I wanted to check out that my body was fine.
Were you okay?
Yes, I was. Yeah, yeah.
Good effort.
Oh, yeah, wow. I mean, at the end of the day, better to be slightly hurt using the seat than dead.
We're actually we're quite lucky here. Actually, we've got four Harrier operators, and for only 25% to have ejected, it's quite a good.
You're the only three that haven't.
There was a point at the end of the 90s when it was happening every other day.
Yeah.
It was ridiculous. I guess on that note, we're very glad you're here, Blackers, and for both of you, and we're going to catch up with Ed for a bit more,
and to give us time 3 days before sailing, to ask.
Thank you so much.
It's been an absolute pleasure. So, thank you. I'm going to depart. Ed's going to, I think, give you a bit of a look around the ship and some more.
And if you have us, we'll have to come back and see how it was. After the deployment in the next few weeks.
We could fly out to America.
Maybe we do that. Hey, but thanks very much.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Well, I'm sure we can all agree that was bloody brilliant.
Just one more thing before we go to questions. I know we thanked him on board there, but a huge thank you to Ed and Blackers there for pulling out all the stops to get us on board and they went way above and beyond as well with the tour of the carrier, getting out onto the flight deck and everything. And right now, as we speak, they are somewhere in the North Atlantic, probably sailing through the remnants of the hurricane as well. So, you know, everything we've talked about is fully in perspective now with those guys doing their jobs on board.
Well. Do you remember them telling us they had a small problem with the carrier? Do you remember that? The small problem was they wanted to test it in high seas, and they couldn't find seas high enough to adequately, well, to move it adequately enough to test it.
Yeah, that's right, because they'd gone to the highest sea states they could find, and she still didn't shift.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds like a humble brag to me, but anyway.
Oh, we're introducing humble brag onto this as well.
Exactly right.
You're definitely crossing the streams.
Yes. Yeah, actually, before we go into... let's not do that. Let's just go straight into questions. Goddard, hit me with some questions, please.
Right. Now, I'm just scrolling through to find a particular question. It was Ian Savage. He was straight back there, friend of the pod, which I think is a really good question and crosses definitely our favourite subject here. Would you have fancied trying to land a Spitfire with its narrow landing gear onto an aircraft carrier?
Yes.
Would that be before or after you won the Red Bull Air Race?
No. Right. Let's go back to the banana boat carrier.
Yeah. I was talking to a mate down at Hecorn. He'd operated Corsairs and Seafires, and he said 115 landings he'd done.
Hang on, which Corsair?
Yeah, no, Corsair and Spitfire, Seafire. And I kind of went, oh, mate, I bet the Corsair was so much better because it had wider gear. You know, it was more sort of suited for it. But it did have a very long nose. But essentially, he was just a brilliant dude. He went, no, they're all right. he was so, you know, just chilled about it. He went, you know, he absolutely had to do curved approach and kind of nail the speed. And you really looked at the mates with battens to tell you if you were high or low. You know, that's how they kind of used to signal it. But he said, he goes, you know, the spit wasn't such a nightmare as you thought it would be. But, you know, for us having flown it, thinking of landing that thing on something that's wobbly, that's moving, that's tiny, that you've got to nail it and hit a cable, you know, utterly beggars belief. I think that, you know, that is extraordinary what those boys did. But he was cool about it.
Yeah, I tell you what, I'd give it a go just because my landings couldn't have been any worse than the ones on the large concrete runways, didn't they? right, here's a good one, actually. Charlie Lyon. What thoughts do you guys have on the Hawker Hunter incident back in 1968, flown by Alan Pollock in protest against the MOD for not recognising the 50th anniversary of the Royal Air Force?
Is he the mate that flew under Tower Bridge?
Yeah. He threw between the struts on Tower Bridge.
Wow.
Yeah. Sorry, move.
Just a quick question. What's the punishment for that?
It must have been his last trip, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think he got... I don't think he went to jail, did he? But you probably would nowadays, wouldn't you?
I would be...
You'd be shot down by a typhoon on the way there.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, no, you'd be flying
the
typhoon.
The equivalent would be a typhoon doing it, wouldn't
you? You'd be chased by other typhoons.
Decent race. Oh, that'd be good, wouldn't it?
Your typhoon being chased by subsequent typhoons as you protest the lack of anniversary celebrations for the RAF.
I mean, the French movie that we talked about recently with the mirages in it,
the one with the amazing
Chevalier du Siècle.
Yes,
the Knights of the Sky. That's exactly that, isn't it? Someone's stolen a black mirage and is a baddie, and the good mirages are chasing it around the place.
I mean, that can't last for too long because once you run out of fuel, you run out of fuel.
I tell you what. So, what are my thoughts on it? Flippin' heck, he must have been cross to do that.
Cross or mad?
And
I don't mean mad angry. I mean like mad.
I'm telling you, it's a pretty, having, you know, all of us flown over London, the Thames, it's quite bendy, isn't it? You know, it's not like you can line up and have a nice little aim at it for a while. He must have. That is some flying to get it. I mean, it's got to be 20 foot or something to get a Hunter down that low on the Thames. It's
I mean, well, he went through above the road, but below the tower bit. You know, he didn't go underneath the road bit.
It's
no, that'd be more impressive.
Oh, no, I'm not taking away from him, but I'm just, you know, but yeah, he went between the two. But no, I do absolutely.
It kind of feels like he wasn't thinking straight just to peel off and go and do that because he was cross. But then he came back and landed at his home airfield.
So my thought on this, right, is that this was a dare of some sort, and the protest was retrospective. So once he'd got caught, it's like, right, you need a damn good excuse to be flying underneath Tower Bridge. What about the anniversary of the RAF? Okay, you're not going to jail. That's how I see this unfolding, rather than he's protesting, rather than it's a pre-planned protest.
There's a picture on One Squadron of the very event because it was a One Squadron Hunter. So, so there's a picture on the squadron of the Hunter flying, under the arch of the bridge.
Do we know what happened to it? That is one that we need to find out.
We'll have to perhaps have a bit of a Google fest. And,
He seems to have achieved his goal, though, doesn't he? Because if it was a truly shameful event, it would not be on the wall of One Squadron.
Well,
no, so I mean, it's pretty famous, though, and they had to do a painting because there were no pictures.
So I guess the moral of this story is if you're currently flying in the RAF and you want, you know, fame forevermore, go fly over Tower Bridge.
Yeah, it's probably not the soundbite that God has wanted.
Good suggestion, JB.
Yeah, maybe don't do that if you're in the Royal Air Force and you're listening to this pod.
No, that's the official line, right? So your official line. Your official line is. Oh, have you? So your official line is don't do it. The unofficial line is you'll then buy a painting of that event.
No, they did. They did.
To sum up, the official line is don't do it. The unofficial line is do it.
So it said in the immediate aftermath of the incident, his unit, blimey, was posted to North Africa without him while he remained on a charge. All right, I've got you. Okay. He was subsequently invalided out of the RAF on medical grounds. This avoided a court-martial and the embarrassment of the government of Pollock giving a reason for his stunt and perhaps receiving the support of the public.
Like I said, I think he was properly mad, sir.
Yes, yes, quite. Excellent stuff. That's a great question.
It is worth mentioning. In fact, I'm just going to read this out. On the 5th of April, 68, Pollock decided on his own initiative, talked about that, to mark the occasion of the RAF anniversary with an unauthorised display. His flight left the soon-to-be-closed RAF Tangmere in Sussex to turn to West Raynham in Norfolk, a route that took him over London. Immediately after takeoff, Pollock left the flight and flew low-level. Having beaten up Dunsfold Aerodrome, Hawker's home airfield, he then took his Hawker Hunter FJ9 single-seater grounder check jet over London, circled the Houses of Parliament three times as a demonstration against Prime Minister Harold Wilson's government, dipped his wings over the Royal Air Force Memorial on the embankment, and finally flew under the top span of Tower Bridge.
can you imagine going rogue in an F-16 around the White House three times? Wow. Now, just a lead on from this. Is that picture of a Hawker Hunter flying through the hangar legitimate?
Oh, yeah.
Is it really? I was
a Hunter or a Jaguar?
I think it's a Hunter. I think the Jaguar came in.
There's a few very good pictures, particularly in Oman, where I don't think the rules were... I mean, the rules weren't quite as tight back in the 50s in the UK, but in Oman, I'm not sure there were any rules. And there's pictures of Jaguars at quite literally 3 feet, and going through hangars and that sort of stuff.
Well, did you see the Flogger video that I posted, that I tweeted
yes,
the other day?
Yes, I saw it.
See, oh, if you God, spent a little less time on Twitter.
6 inches above the ground in this thing, doing about 600 knots across an airfield.
It's impressive.
What kind of breakdown in sort of discipline has to happen before a fighter jet is flown through a hangar?
I mean...
Well, I will refer you to when Dunk was talking about beards at the beginning of the podcast. He said, I can't quite remember the rules.
I tell you what, there is a lesson there. It starts with beards.
we're gonna see a prefect in 2 weeks' time throughout
upside down.
So JB, here's an interesting point, or I find it interesting. The other boys are just gonna take the mickey out of me. But someone was asking me about, you know, why do people have to salute the flag on the station commander's car? And one of the things is, there's a great phrase, is the standard you walk past is the standard you accept. So when I was a station commander, you'd see people walking along the road and you'd kind of see them and you'd go, come on, son, you can salute. Go on. You know, oh, you didn't. So I'd stop the car.
Oh, no.
I'd reverse back. And I thought about this before I did it for the first time, but I didn't just sound, you know, shout out of the window, what are you doing? You're supposed to salute me because it's all about me. To me, the point was that was the one thing that I knew that they had to do when I drove past. And if they didn't do it, what else were they not doing that they were supposed to be doing? And I was telling this story on a course, and this guy said, I think it was Van Halen, on their rider used to say that, right, we want a big jar, big thing full of whatever, brown M&Ms.
Oh, I know this. I was telling this story literally the other day, literally on Saturday. Yeah. Go on.
And so they pitch up and there's a yellow M&M in there. That's it. Not they're going to throw the teddies out the cot. They then ordered a full structural survey of the place that they were playing in, because it was about attention to detail. And it's funny, what got to me there was your point about beards. It all starts with beards. And so on operations, it's easy for standards to slip because you're on ops, you know, big moustaches going, but there still is a reason to have that discipline, because as soon as it starts slipping, that's when you get people flying through hangars and stuff like that, because it's just the next step.
Yeah, I told that exact same story on Saturday, because I asked in the green room of Twickenham when we were doing our live show, where is my bowl of brown M&Ms?
There you go.
Yeah, but the reason I...
Did they bring one?
The reason I understood it was because it was a breach of contract. So if they'd... In the contract, it would say no yellow M&Ms, or only yellow M&Ms, or only Doritos which are unbroken. So if there was something wrong with the venue or they didn't like it, they could walk out because the contract had already been breached by the M&Ms.
There you go. But whatever it is, it's about attention to detail, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I've just got a rugby one on that, which is a player called Jamie Peacock, who played for the longest time in rugby league. And his thing to the kids, to the academy lads, is you always touch the cone. So you're sprinting between two cones, you always step to the cone or over it. Because he did a little calculation, which is if you were a yard short of that cone, you had, you know, 20 sprints, and then, you know, you'd be doing that multiple times a week over multiple months, over multiple years, how much work have you missed out? How much does that attention to detail cost you? And it's a good point.
Yeah, that's a very good point. See, look at that. Right, because with the interview, we've been going for about 3.5 hours.
A million years.
A million years. Here's a good one. And I do want this to be the subject of the next podcast. But watching the Top Gun, this is from Nick Blakow. Watching the Top Gun 2 trailer, and Tom Cruise isn't wearing gloves when flying the F-18. And I notice there's a trend among pilots of cutting off the fingers of gloves and of using the switches in flight. Is this safe? How do you touch screens in the F-35 if the pilot is wearing gloves? Now, I think I did a little thing on Twitter about this, because I noticed exactly that and mentioned someone. I think it was on the ITV program that one of the American guys had cut the end of the finger off of his glove. The guys that I flew with, a lot of the guys in the F-16, used to cut the fingers off of button-pressing parts of the glove. And that was a factor of the US Air Force flying glove being this big sort of thick green, like the sort of, not a mitten, but, you know, a big old thick glove that you'd put on to go outside. Whereas the RAF flying glove that the three of us have worn forever is so soft and smooth, you don't need to do anything with that in order to, you know, be able to feel all the buttons and switches.
Parky's face.
Yeah.
Very much like it.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, what do you think, boys? Parker, you must have, I don't know what the, I guess the Dutch guys flew with the American gloves. Did you ever fly with them? I couldn't. I didn't like them at all.
Yeah, I guess sort of back in the, I learned, but it, that was on sort of aircraft where you didn't really need it. But the, you're right, the sort of the big displays in the Typhoon, I tended to, I don't know why, I would not wear my gloves until literally just before takeoff. So doing most of the sort of messing around with the kits, I just preferred not wearing them. But it was okay, wasn't it, with the RAF gloves? But
I never took my gloves off. Didn't like it.
No, I don't really. I tend to not fly with gloves so much now, but that's because I'm old.
Hey, Dunk, anything to add on gloves?
Nothing at all.
What, you got no hot glove chat whatsoever?
Right, so here's one, and I'm going to give you some advertising here, Dunk, but this is from Lisa Harding, friend of the pod, is which, by the way, did you see any of her things on Twitter? I think it's a particular program that does some sort of time-lapse-y. So there was a picture of a hot start and a Spitfire with the flames coming out, and then but the clouds moving over the top. So it was like a moving photo. Ah, it was flipping. Don't say it's a video, a moving photo. There was a particular way.
Is this like synchronized walking?
Yeah, it's like synchronized walking. But Lisa said,
"Fangled moving photos."
I love this actually. The fact that
YouTube, eh?
Look, I got it in there before you boys.
You did. Well done.
Is the Mason? I love the fact you are called the Mason, like the Donald. Looking forward to his grilling at the Petwood Hotel on the 28th of September for the John Egging Trust. And is he bringing Parky for backup?
Well, I am looking forward to it. It'll be great. But, you know, we're talking about John Egging Trust, which is a charity close to all of our hearts, I know, because John lost his life, sadly, when Goddard and I were down at Bournemouth displaying. And the charity that's been set up by his wife in his name does some fantastic work. So I'm actually organising a bicycle ride, which is a week on Sunday. So I've got that to sort of concentrate on first, but then a week later then is the event at the Petwood, which I'm really looking forward to. I haven't really, as per usual with these things, and I'm God, as I'm sure you're just the same, I haven't really thought very much about what I'm going to say. I think just get out there and dit on much as we do now. And you know, I think the grilling side of things, as you say, the questions are actually the most interesting part, aren't they? Because you can interact a little with the audience, yeah. And at least they're asking you the questions that they want to hear the answer to. So, no, I'm really looking forward to it. It'll be great.
Yeah, I did exactly that up at RAF Cosford 2 weekends ago. Drove up there and I mean, it was a reasonable turnout. It was about 80 or 90 people. And I ditted on about flying on BBM. Some of the stories there, and we had some great questions and answers in there. It was brilliant.
Any jokes?
Told some jokes.
I told lots of jokes. Not going to tell you then.
Exactly right.
Classified.
I think that we should just say before we move any further, because we have sort of given Goddard a bit of a hard time about the jokes this evening, but he is, in my experience, the master of pulling out a joke on the spot. He knows like a billion of them. Much like Parky can remember all sorts of paraphernalia about different aeroplanes, Goddard can pull out a joke on the spot. And sadly, he shied away from it this evening. But, I think we should try and just encourage him one last time. Come on, give us your best joke. Come on, give us a good one.
What bees make milk?
Go on.
Boobies. anyway.
Excellent.
So the one I was going to say on this particular point that the reason I saw JB on Saturday is because JB in his other life, his main life of the Egg Chasers podcast, had done a live show at Twickenham. I listened to that the other day and I was just saying to JB before we started, it was flipping brilliant, you know, and it sounded like the interaction with the audience and everything that you did there, JB, was really good. We had talked about with Lisa possibly doing one. We need to get on and do this. I'd love to do a live pod just before
I would love to do it.
We will. It will definitely happen probably sometime in 2025, I would imagine.
I'd say so, yeah. I'd say so.
When we definitely will get there.
When our diaries clear up a bit. 2025. Okay, well, before we end this, I just want to add at least one other thing. Me and Goddard's ended
Goddard's
up...
Goddard's
nice. Yes, thank you.
And you, Duncan.
Ended up getting interviewed by a magazine called Wings. I was wondering, have you seen Wings? Have you been interviewed by them yet?
Who, me?
Yes. Well, both of you. You're both meant to be interviewed by now.
No one's... I haven't heard from them.
Well,
they're going to be in touch. These guys are amazing.
Yes. That's the point. If you like this this podcast, you're going to love this magazine. Me and Goddard were lucky enough to meet the guys that do it. It's basically a labour of love. It is the magazine version of what we are doing. And just mighty impressive guys. So if you get the chance and you want to have a look at the magazine, Wings, I think it'll be third edition soon, and there'll be an interview with me, Goddard, and actually you two, but you don't know about it yet.
Right.
Yeah, the guys were brilliant. I was just so impressed about a guy who was passionate about doing something, got off his bum, has tried to do it on a shoestring, but it's an amazing magazine, you know, real beautiful photographs in there as well. Just fantastic.
Yeah. I would add this as well. We did it at Biggin Hill. Now, Biggin Hill seems like the most illegal facility that I've ever seen. I imagine if you were going to fly in illicit contraband, Biggin Hill would be the place to do it. It just has that feel, that overall feel.
That's because that's probably the first sort of private airfield you've ever been to, isn't it?
Yeah, I was like, wow.
Because you're used to massive security in... that's exactly what it is. Plus, you know, I grew up near Biggin Hill. I love being at that place. There's so much history in that place.
Yeah, and I know what you mean, though. I mean, all of us went to do our officer selection at Biggin Hill, so it's got a special place probably for us, you know, right at the very start of our career. So we've got that, but of course all of the Battle of Britain history, and of course the fact that we then flew in there on the Battle of Britain memorial flight, Biggin Hill definitely has a very special place, I think, in all of our hearts. I'm pretty sure I can say, but I do know what you mean, JB. I'd never really thought of it like that. It's interesting the sort of persona that you're sort of now, you know, morphing into. I kind of thought, well, JB just plays rugby, but it's more about sort of spying and Vlad the handler. And do you know, I'm reading a book at the moment, and part of the book was a weapons dealer selling two SU-31s to North Korea, and you sprang to mind. Don't know why that would be.
I mean, if you know anywhere which I can get an SG-31, please let me know. And do you know where I'd find them from? What? Biggin Hill.
Well, if you look at, I know where you've seen it before, JB, and this was probably subliminal, but it's Biggin Hill in, what's that Dan Brown movie?
Da Vinci Code.
Da Vinci Code.
Yes.
So in the Da Vinci Code, when they fly from Europe, Paris to Biggin Hill, to England, they land at Biggin Hill, and when they're doing the shenanigans with the car and getting them out of the aeroplane quickly, Tom Hanks and the... and the other guys, it's filmed there in the hangars out the back. So that's probably what you're thinking of.
So what
the police get there.
So what they do there, have you seen the bit where they buy the train tickets with their credit cards because they know they're going to trace the credit cards, and then they do something else? Classic bit of misdirection, that oldest trick in the book.
There you go.
I've got a request. Could all of Goddard's Twitterati followers just encourage him to spend just a tiny bit less time on Twitter, and then he can put the Duxford podcast out, which
yes,
he did. We did a load of really good stuff.
Sorry,
it's sat there. It's languishing on his phone.
You
get your finger out, Air Commodore.
For a Slack moment.
Yeah. If you're interested in Twitter threads, which are not Goddard's Twitter thread, check out. There's a defence. Twitter, can't remember, Goddard will know what it is, who do the most interesting threads on things like cable ties and shipping containers.
It's
Defense. A weird man, JB.
Think Defence, is it?
Yeah, I was about to say, is it Think Defence?
Yeah, honestly, read their threads about things like cable ties. You will be astonished. Astonished.
Think Defence is a very good one, actually.
And bridges. And how to transport shit. It's amazing. Right, there we go, done. Follow us on Twitter at Pilot Episodes Pod. You won't find us on Facebook because we're not there. And we might do a live podcast one day from somewhere near you, but maybe not. Until then, we will come up with another date and probably have another podcast maybe next month. So from me, Dunk and Parky, goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Bye. And we're out.
Well done.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.